You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I assume you're familiar with the Dewey Decimal System?
Where you are in your life has a lot to do with how you feel about a book when you're reading it.
Hey, you're pretty smart. How'd you get so smart?
Reading.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today's show is about the joys and the challenges of reading.
Favorite book? Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It was just so alluring and made me hungry all the time.
The writer Toni Morrison reinvents the children's fable.
Your stomach's full, your bed is warm, your house is clean, but where's your dream? Know what I mean?
And we look at how Don Quixote's book madness still thrills us.
You've got a princess, you've got a fantastic head of a giant, you've even got mice jousting with each other.
My guest is the author Sarah Nelson. She just wrote a book about reading a book every week for a year. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Like it or not, almost every cultural artifact is a product. My neighbor down the block wants to sell the abstract art she makes, just as my TV producer neighbor up the street wants to sell the rock and roll show that he's dreamed up. In America, the marketplace drives the culture. And every couple of days lately, there's been a news story that's reminded me of this truism in a surprising way. Like the article in the New York Times about Hollywood's strong disinclination these days to make R-rated or PG-rated movies. Kids under 17 can't go to R movies by themselves, and they won't go to PG movies, too uncool. So in order to maximize the audience, that is, in order to sell tickets to as many teenagers as possible, Hollywood is now obsessed with making PG-13 movies. Of the top 20 movies at the box office last year, 13 of them were PG-13, and not a single one was rated R. Not that there aren't terrific PG-13 movies occasionally, like, say, Pirates of the Caribbean.
You best start believing in ghost stories. You're in one.
But if fewer and fewer R-rated ideas and scripts get pushed through the pipeline by writers and directors and studios, then great, tough, edgy movies don't get made as frequently as they did 20 or 30 years ago.
Number two.
Films like The Graduate or Midnight Cowboy or Five Easy Pieces just don't show up in the theaters.
Anything else?
Yeah, now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
And market forces are about to transform live entertainment as well. Ticketmaster, which virtually monopolizes the live concert and theater ticket business in America, plans to start auctioning off all the best seats online. In other words, no more top price of $80 or $90 for the Stones concert or $120 for the Road Company production of Hairspray. Ticketmaster plans to sell the seats for $90 or $120 or $900 if that's what somebody will pay. I'm a believer in the free market, for better or worse. The fair price for anything is whatever somebody will pay. But I have to admit that this final step into cultural laissez-faire is a slightly disconcerting idea. Maybe I'm more of a traditionalist than I realized. Because I also have to admit that the third recent story about the cultural marketplace pleased me because it suggested that there are still lines that can't be easily crossed. Advertising, as you know, has been creeping into all kinds of places where it never used to appear. Schools and doctor's offices and bathroom walls, to name a few. And lately, inside taxi cabs. For the last year, closed-circuit TVs have been installed in the backs of taxis in cities like Chicago and New York. The idea is to entertain passengers with little bits of trivia, and then, of course, to force this captive audience to watch commercials. Annoying, sure, but inevitable, right? Maybe not. Amazingly, in New York City, the Taxi Commission just canceled the program. How come? No one's saying, but it is apparently simply for reasons of taste. The Taxi TV programming was just too cheesy. Maybe the free market is not quite as inexorable as we thought. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I've always liked pool tables, and I find it very hard to resist shooting a few balls when I run across one in a bar or somebody's basement. But until I heard Ken Carbone in today's Design for the Real World, I had no idea all that a pool table has been and can be.
Originally, it was a game played by kings as well as commoners. It's probably been played since the 15th century. It originally started out as a lawn game, not unlike croquet. Hence, that's where the green felt came into play, to simulate the feeling of playing on the lawn. What I always loved about pool, aside from the playing the game, was the whole aesthetic experience. It is unbelievably theatrical to me. I see the balls as almost like characters on a stage. The whole thing, the symmetry of the game, the six pockets, the contrast between the kind of shiny, hard surface of the ball and the soft green felt. I recently saw a stripped down table. New felt was being applied. And it's some kind of gray stone, which is like a soapstone. The weight of it contributes to the sense of stability about the game and the sound of the game, the way the balls roll across the table. The table has to be heavy and strong because of the leaning over it. Hit the two ball, draw it back into position where I may be in better position for the one ball. So let's see what happens. We have 15 colors, and they're all distinct, and they're all kind of quintessential. When you know the two ball is that certain color blue, or the four ball is that violet color, but again it's that wonderful array, that compositional work that happens with the balls and their distribution on the green felt. This game is enormously elegant. It has an artfulness to it, which I think is of the highest caliber, and at the same time, there's deep science involved in this game. The physics of the game, the finesse it takes, it's not a game that requires a lot of power. But I love the whole almost ballet of it. Bend over the table, align the balls, decide the distance of the cue ball to your object ball. I'm trying to get the one ball in that side pocket. I think my chances of clearing the cushion are not very good. So if I try this shot, I have to hit the one ball with the right amount of propulsion. See, I missed that. I remember playing a game with a pretty good pool player, and I was doing particularly bad, and he said to me, "You know, Pythagoras, you're not." It's pure design. It's designing every shot that you're going to make.
Ken Carbone is principal designer at Carbone Smolin Agency and the author of the book, The Virtuosos. Our piece was produced by Jocelyn Gonzalez. I'm Kurt Anderson, and it's time for today's cover story about reading. You've probably heard the depressing statistics, like how half of Americans don't buy a single book in any given year. But just a subway ride away from where I'm sitting right now is a library that circulates 16.8 million books a year, more than any other in the country. It's the public library in the New York borough of Queens.
I'm Richard. The first book that wasn't read to me, I think I was in first grade. I remember it had a green cover and it was called Planes for Bob and Andy. And I really can't remember much of what it was like, but I remember it took me about a month to read because I could only read about a page or two a day, and I thought it was really terrific. I think if I was forced to read a book in school that I hated, it might have turned me against reading forever. But my first one, I read myself and I liked it, so maybe that's why.
Hi, my name is Subhas Speak. I'm from Queens Village. I was born in Pakistan. My favorite book was in eighth grade. It was called Flowers for Algernon. I really liked it. It was so sad. It was like so, like, why do people have to suffer this way, you know? I think I like to read, like, non-fictional books, like books that really happened, or books that make you think, like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
I'm Rodney, and I'm from Queens. I usually read in the mop closet at my job when I'm on break.
We're talking today all about the pleasures and some of the peculiarities of reading. Sarah Nelson is a reading junkie. She is the publishing columnist for the New York Observer and the books editor for Glamour magazine. Last year, she read a book every week, apart from what she read for her jobs, and she's written a book about that experience called So Many Books, So Little Time, A Year of Passionate Reading. Sarah Nelson, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
We can depress ourselves by looking at the statistics about the half of America that never buys a book and never reads a book. But clearly, there are signs all over that a reading culture is really thriving in this country, from the success of Amazon and Barnes & Noble and the Oprah Winfrey Book Club. Clearly, there are Americans, a lot of Americans, who love to read. So is that glass half full or half empty in your estimation?
I think that there have always been, you know, maniacal book people. And I think, you know, I think book people are and I count myself as one, so I feel like I can say this. I mean, I think book people are a little nuts. I mean, I have a group of friends that talk about books as if they were our friends. You know, did you read the new Pete Dexter? Well, you know, I didn't like the part where he, you know, as if we knew the guy, you know, which we don't.
So it's as if the authors are your friends.
As if the authors are our friends, as if the characters are our friends. You know, I didn't like where she did this on page 93. You know, who's she? You know, but it's almost like, you know, we speak in a language only other, you know, book maniacs can understand. And I notice with my husband, for example, who does know how to read and does read a lot of newspapers and magazines, but he's not a book reader. And he'll be with me someplace or come in and overhear me on the telephone talking to somebody, and he has absolutely, I mean, it's like listening to my son talk about Pokemon. You know, what are you talking about?
I'm just curious about at what point or by what means the reading bug gets inculcated. When did you become the kind of avid reader that you are today?
Well, when I was about 13 or so, my mother, who was a big reader, started to give me grown-up books. And she gave me Marjorie Morningstar, which was a 50s novel by Herman Wouk that was about an Upper West Side girl who was going to be an actress, and she was, you know, not going to be a bourgeois matron like her parents were, and she fell in love with the wrong man and traveled to Europe. And I remember reading that book. I remember very clearly her giving it to me, you know, going to my room and reading it, staying up all night, you know, and that feeling that you get of like, I just, you know, just one more chapter, just one more chapter. I'll go to sleep soon. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and taking it so personally. I mean, I remember going into my mother's room the next day, having finished it. I think I probably read it, you know, in 12 hours or something. And, you know, in the end, the girl doesn't marry the guy who's bad for her. She marries the right doctor or lawyer or whatever she's supposed to do. And, you know, I was 13 years old. I mean, this was just the most incredible shock to me.
And you confronted your mom about this?
I did. I mean, weeping, you know, and she was just, I could still remember it. I mean, she was just like, oh, boy, you know, this is not what I signed on for here. And I went back and I read that book, Marjorie Morningstar, last year. And, you know, it's really a different book when you read it as an adult and as a parent. And, you know, now I read it and I think, you know, she should have listened to her mother. You know?
Well, it's funny. How books, or for that matter, movies and plays, in their kind of unchanging way, become markers for how we change. Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina were two of the books that you hadn't read before you started this project, or you had?
No, I had not read either of them.
Well, I would love you to read the beginning of this chapter, which you wrote, I guess, last August 20th, called Anna, Emma, and Me.
Okay. One of the good things about having a partner who is just a tiny bit oblivious to the links between reading and life is that he doesn't take particular note that the two books you've brought on your 3-week family vacation are Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary. In my imagination, the one where my life is a sitcom, Leo would notice me piling the two classics about adultery on the bedside table in our new rented master bedroom on Fire Island, and he'd turn into Paul Reiser or Will from Will and Grace or somebody and ask, "Hey, what's with the books about cheating? You trying to tell me something?" And I'd say, "No, of course not, honey." But then the 27-minute plot would reveal that, well, he didn't really believe me and was in fact running around misreading all sorts of innocent remarks and behaviors and had worked himself into a good righteous frenzy before his folly was revealed in some meet-cute way. Then we'd make up and live happily ever after.
And so you really took the two classics about adultery on vacation with your husband. Was there anything more than an amusing coincidence there?
No, but there was a reason that I took those two books on vacation with my husband and my son. And it took me a long time to figure out what it was. And what I realized was that I behave towards my books the way people behave toward their secret lovers. I mean, that it's really like my secret life. And there are, you know, days when I lie to my husband and I say, I have to stay late at the office because I'm like in the middle of some book and I just don't want to, you know, go home.
And in your case, even more since your husband, as you've said, isn't a great reader. So right. It's even more like this.
Well,
this.
I mean, he just would. I mean, of all the stories that he would buy, that is not one of them. I mean, no, really, I'm not having an affair. I'm really staying in the office to read a book. I mean, he would just think that was completely weird, though in my case would be true. So I realized that that's what I think, you know, that it's all the passion in these books and all the kind of secrecy and the sort of joyful secrecy. I mean, being a book maniac is as much fun as having adultery without the guilt, you know, I guess.
The author and reader, Sarah Nelson, is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. And coming up, we'll hear the novelist Toni Morrison, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist, read from her new children's books. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and today we are talking about reading books.
My name is Kristen Nell. I'm from Brooklyn. My favorite book to read is Clifford. When I read the book, it's like I'm reading finally, and I'm just ready to read and go to second grade. And it's fun. People say it's not fun, but it sure is fun.
My name is Kurt. I'm from Brooklyn, too. And today we will be hearing from regular people like Kirsten L. throughout the program. My guest is the author Sarah Nelson. And our first story today, as part of the cover story, is with a very famous writer and reader, Toni Morrison, who's won both the Nobel Prize and the Pulitzer and has sold millions of copies of her various books like Beloved, Paradise, and Song of Solomon. Recently, Toni Morrison began writing books for children. They're 6 traditional fables that she adapted with her son, Slade. And Morrison says that she didn't read too many kids' books herself when she was young.
I'm a kid in the 30s. I'm in a small town. It's the Depression. There are no bookstores in that town. There is one library. their so-called children's section you could get through in a week or 2 days. And there were no such things as young adult books. So I read whatever was in the children's section, which were primarily picture books. And then I just started reading books throughout the library. I would mix Jane Austen with junk. I mean, I didn't know the difference between the two at that time. But, yeah, I read indiscriminately. I was always hungry for narrative, always, and never felt comfortable without books. Even now, when I pack to go on a trip, the big thing is how many books can I take? My terror of being alone somehow and stranded without anything to read is profound. My son and I and a friend were sitting around the table laughing at how horrified we were by so many children's stories, which were primarily Aesop's stories, Grimm's fairy tales, you know, the horror of Little Red Riding Hood. I mean, just terrible, scary stuff. And my son said that the one that irritated him most was the ant and the grasshopper. The ant and the grasshopper are friendly in the summer. When fall comes, the ant does what ants do, saves, hoards, is very active, is very persistent, and is prepared for bad weather. The grasshopper, on the other hand, just makes these little noises and hops around during the summer, and when the winter comes, he dies because he has no provisions. The lesson being, look into the future and prepare for it, and don't be an idiot and waste your time in the summer. And that's the basic story. It didn't help you think. It made you absorb the lesson, but not to create or critique or have any active participation in the story. So what we did was to reconsider those morals and to take the story in a different direction. Foxy G and his ace, Kid A, were hanging in the park. They romped each day till the sun's last ray and didn't stop till dark. They climbed trees, tore up their knees, dunked balls and shot hoops from afar, swam in the pool where the water was cool, and sang with their air guitars. One hot day, as they lay in the shade, Kid A turned to his friend and said, "Gotta split, Foxy. The summer's been fun. Time to dump this place. Get back in the race. There's a lot of work to be done." "Hold on. I just thought of a tune. Listen up, kid. This will rocket the moon." Foxy raised his wings, rubbed them hard, making music so deaf it drew a crowd. "That's cool, Foxy G, but listen to me. Vacation is gone. The day's getting short. We can't hang forever on the basketball court." "Then split, Kid A. Who's in your way?" "As for me, Foxy G, I have to let my music out." And the grasshopper is just so thrilled with his music. He just has to play and play, and it starts to snow, and he's alone and hungry. So we don't stop there. We make him go back to his friend and ask for help. And the friend tells him, "You wasted your time. Why are you coming to me now?" And there is the debate, because they begin to argue. Kid A munched a donut and scoped his friend. "You're cold, hungry, no place to stay. Look at you, man. Well, what can I say? I planned ahead, stored up things. You wasted time on those funky wings." Foxy tried to smile, but it didn't work. The tears in his eyes made him feel like a jerk. He knew he was pitiful and ought to say please, but his pride returned and he fell to his knees. "I quenched your thirst and fed your soul. You can't spare me a donut hole. You should have known what tomorrow would bring. Then you wouldn't be begging for anything." "I'm an artist. That's what I do. You love my music, so respect me too. How can you say I never worked a day? Art is work. It just looks like play." There is a real argument there. And I, on the one hand, I'll tell you, I thought, oh yeah, the story will end up with the grasshopper being the hero, the artist triumphs, And my son said, no, it's not about who wins. It's about the discussion. It's about who's got game. This is a fundamental argument. And I think even children know that. I mean, think of when they're told that artwork is play, something you do when you don't have important things to do. I love this book. This is the second book in the series, Who's Got Game? It's called The Lion and the Mouse. And you may remember in that story, the lion is king of the desert or the jungle. He gets a thorn in his paw, and no one will help him because they're afraid he'll eat them. And then a mouse does, hoping very much that he will not be eaten in turn. The lion promises, and he takes it out. From there on, the story changes rapidly. But this is the opening. This is the lion being king. Lion, strutting over the wide savanna, raised his head and roared. Listen up. Listen up. No ifs, maybes, ands, or buts. I am the king over all the land. I do what I like. I do what I can. In this place, I make the laws because of my mighty paws.
Toni Morrison is a novelist and now a children's book author, and you can hear our entire conversation with her at studio360.org. Toni Morrison's next novel for adults is called Love, and it comes out in October. I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today about reading with the author Sarah Nelson. The thing that Toni Morrison was saying in that interview, I think, is so true about the kind of unnecessary lack of complexity in so many children's books, which are so didactic.
Right.
Although there are, I mean, we don't want to paint with too broad a brush. I mean, there's A.A. Milne, Winnie the Pooh books, and there's Marie Sendak books.
Right, and there's Dr. Seuss, which was actually something that I did like. But there are a lot of very easy books.
In every sense.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not talking about books you read to, you know, a 2 or 3-year-old. It's more, you know, when kids, before they can read, maybe, but they're 5 or 6 years old, I mean, they have, you know, a much more sophisticated way of thinking, and their reading hasn't caught up with it, and sometimes I think the books are too simplistic.
In their themes and their stories and their morals.
Right, right. I mean, I was not a great reader alouder to my son when he was younger and when he was not able to read himself yet. And I always felt sort of guilty about that because I was always trying to get him, you know, pick the shortest book I could get because then he would fall asleep and he would want me to pick the longest book he could get so that he could stay up later. So we were at cross purposes. And now we have a sort of a new system, which is he can read now. And so when he reads, I read the book along with him, you know, like next to him or the next day or whatever. And then we sort of sort of talk about it. He'll read a chapter and I'll read the chapter and then we'll talk about what happened in the chapter.
Was Charlotte's Web one of the books you read like that together?
Yes, that was one of the books we read like that together.
You have a wonderful story about his reading of Charlotte's Web in your book.
Well, when we did this sort of tag team reading of Charlotte's Web, and he had to answer some questions on it. It was for the summer reading in third grade, I think. And so he had to name his favorite character. And so he said, well, it's the rat. And I said, why? And he said, because he reminded him of a little boy who I won't name, who was kind of funny but really only out for himself. And, you know, he didn't get it initially, but over the course of the reading of the book, he realized that it wasn't really about animals. It was really about interaction, and it was really about people that he knew. So then he said to me, well, you know, who's your favorite character, Mom? And I said, well, I don't know. I think it's Charlotte. And he said, yeah, that figures. And I thought, and I said, really? Why? Kind of
being the heroine of his life.
Right. And, you know, there's a great famous E.B. White line about she was a great friend and a good writer. You know, and I thought, see, you know, the kid really gets it here. And I said, really? Well, why would you ever say such a thing? And he said, well, because she's a girl and she's really kind of bossy. So that was my Charlotte's Web experience with my son.
Well, it proves he had taking a chip off the old block in having a contrarian reading of this story that sometimes is read in too treacly a fashion. Right.
Well, and one might say he's rather perceptive.
Your book is obviously a book about books, which is seems like a very modern idea. All so much fiction of the last 30 years has been written, sort of fiction about fiction and so forth. But obviously that genre didn't begin anytime recently. Cervantes wrote Don Quixote almost exactly 400 years ago as a satire of the adventure tales of his day. And Don Quixote has remained pretty popular, I think, consistently since it was first published. And even if you haven't read Don Quixote, as I'd guess most of us haven't, you probably know the scene in which Don Quixote jousts with windmills, thinking that he's attacking giants.
Don Quixote de la Mancha challenges you to mortal combat, a duel to the death! Or are you...
Matthew Sherman took a look at Don Quixote as a groundbreaking book about books and reading.
The opening pages of Don Quixote describe an aging, unmarried gentleman who's so obsessed by books that he's begun to sell off most of his land to pay for his habit. He doesn't just read these stories, he lives them. The art historian Patrick Lenigan describes an 1863 illustration of Don Quixote sitting in his library.
The scene is just overflowing with the figures from his reading popping out of the books, coming out of the corners, coming in through the windows. You've got a princess appealing to him for her rescue on the lower edge. You've got knights fighting in the background. You've got a fantastic head of a giant on the bottom. You've even got mice jousting with each other.
His imagination finally becomes too big for his library. Don Quixote puts on some rusty armor, mounts his horse, and sets off in search of adventures. He brings along a neighbor, Sancho Panza, to be his squire. Meanwhile, his friends sneak into his library to burn his books in order to rid him of his madness.
"What is that huge thing?" asked the priest. "It is Don Olivante de Laura," answered the barber. "The author of that book also wrote The Flower Garden," said the priest. "And to be frank with you, I cannot make out which of the two is the more truthful or the less mendacious. I can only say that for all its arrogant nonsense, it shall go to the yard."
Readers in Cervantes' time knew these titles well. They were part of a burgeoning genre of chivalric romances, stories of knights who sacrifice everything for their ladies and who never stop for lunch. It was just the sort of highly idealized, unrealistic tripe that a man of Cervantes' intellect couldn't stomach, and which he spends 900 pages lampooning. Patricia Grieve is the chairwoman of the Spanish and Portuguese Department at Columbia University.
At one point, Sancho needs to, in the dark of night, relieve himself. And Don Quixote says, what is that noise? And Sancho says, well, it must be an adventure approaching, hoping that Don Quixote won't find out. And then Don Quixote says, but what is that odor?
For most of the 17th century, it is the rough-and-tumble humor of slapstick and physical aspects, bodily functions, that they just found uproarious.
The two men don't come upon any giants or damsels or dragons, or at least Sancho doesn't see them, but his master certainly does.
"Monstrous and diabolical crew," Don Quixote called out. "Release immediately the noble princesses whom you are forcibly carrying off in that coach, or prepare to receive instant death." "Sir Knight," they replied, "we're neither monstrous nor diabolical, but two monks of St. Benedict traveling about our business." "No fair speeches for me, for I know you perfidious scoundrels," cried Don Quixote. Then, without waiting for the reply, he spurred his horse and, with his lance lowered, charged at the foremost monk with such vigor and fury that if he had not slid from his mule, he would have been thrown to the ground and badly hurt.
Now, one of the reasons that this book continues to appeal through the centuries is that although most of us don't think we're knights errant, we constantly come up against situations in which we have an ideal and we have a particular virtue that we would like to embody and embrace. And the particular circumstances are making it very difficult to live up to a certain ideal.
"It is I, Don Quixote de la Mancha! Does that name strike fear in your heart?"
Don Quixote was an instant hit when it appeared in 1605, so much so that another writer stole his characters and published his own sequel a few years later. Cervantes couldn't sue for copyright infringement. He could only outwit his rival. In Cervantes's Part II, completed in 1615, Don Quixote actually meets a character from the bogus Part II.
"I beg your worship," Don Quixote said, "to be so kind as to make a declaration before the mayor of this place that you have never seen me in all the days of your life till today, and that I am not the Don Quixote written of in the second part, nor is this Sancho Panza, my squire, the man your worship knew." "I'll do that with very great pleasure," replied Don Álvaro, "for it's very surprising to see two Don Quixotes and two Sanchos at the same time, alike in their names, yet how very different in their deeds. Let me affirm once more that I did not see what I did see, and that what happened to me did not happen."
At this point, the blurring of the lines between fact, fiction, various readers is just over the top.
For Cervantes, the story was the thing. It's a story about storytelling. But if the story itself doesn't grab you, he doesn't want you as a reader. And he really does tell a great, great tale.
"Cowards, do you retreat? I see you scatter like sheep before me."
For Studio 360, I'm Matthew Sherman.
"Don't worry, Sancho! The danger is over! We've won a famous victory!"
"Hooray!"
I'm Kurt Anderson with the author Sarah Nelson, and we are talking today about reading. I had no idea about this second part of Don Quixote that reacted to this unauthorized sequel and incorporated the characters. How modern and amazing.
And how amazing that none of us who are supposed to be so well-educated even knew about it. I mean, when I think of Don Quixote, I remember, you know, and we've all seen the movies and had the plays. But I had no idea that so much of it is about writing and is about storytelling. I mean, obviously the whole book is about a guy who has a lot of illusions and who makes up stories about his life, but that there was this whole other thing. I mean, I don't know if we didn't get taught it in school or what, but I was...
Well, it's also as though what we were taught in school and what things like Man of La Mancha incorporated sounds as though it was not exactly what Cervantes didn't want, which is this very earnest, serious sort of view of this quixotic, idealist, rather than the spoof that it was.
Well, except on the other hand, he thought the story was the thing, as I just said. So, I mean, so what we all remember is the plot and the story and not the philosophizing.
The other thing about Don Quixote, as you say, we weren't really taught that it was among other things, a satire and a funny book. But when you think about it, so many of the great works, you know, the English novelists of the 18th century like Fielding and Smollett and then Mark Twain. So many of the great works are funny. And yet we don't, greatness and comedy don't generally, go together in the canon.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like Woody Allen's famous line about, that he wanted to make a serious movie because he wanted to sit at the grown-ups table, that to write comedy, or to make a comic movie was somehow, childish or, not fully grown up. And I think that the sort of reverse, the other side of that is that we're taught in school, this is a great book. And immediately, you put on your great book hat, and this is, I have to take this very seriously.
So therefore Huckleberry Finn is about slavery and not,
right,
it's not
right,
a funny romp.
Right, right, exactly. And there's sort of no, there's no crossover. And I think, I think that people feel that way about reading a lot, that reading is a certain kind of homework and that if you're reading a serious book, you must be very serious about it. And I think a lot of people, miss out on a lot of stuff that way.
I'm Kurt Anderson talking today with Sarah Nelson. In a minute, we're going to hear from an immigrant community in America that is seeing its native language on the page for the very first time. This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and on today's show, we are talking about reading.
My name is Robert, and I'm here. I'm from Haiti. My favorite book is the Bible, of course. And I usually, you know, come to the library to read. I like reading. It's a part of my life, you know. By reading, you acquire wisdom.
When that man reads the Bible, he's also reading the 4,000-year history and stories of a Mesopotamian culture. But lots of cultures don't have books like the Bible to document their stories. In fact, the Hmong people scattered across Southeast Asia had no written language at all until just 50 years ago. Their literature thrived simply as an oral tradition. Today, St. Paul, Minnesota is home to more Hmong people than any other city in the world. Lots of them fled there from Laos and Cambodia shortly after the Vietnam War. Steve Nelson of Minnesota Public Radio finds that St. Paul also has become the center of an emerging group of Hmong writers. They're working in English, but for the first time in their own native language as well.
This is Chublong Vang. He's 36, and he's reading from his short story called A Letter of Tidings. It's written as a series of three letters between a husband and wife separated more than 20 years ago when they tried to escape Laos across the Mekong River. This is the first letter. The wife is searching for her husband, who didn't make it across.
Used to hear people tell me a lot about the struggle when they crossed the Mekong River. Some people, they lost their loved one. And I bring all those stories, the true story together, make a real person, and then put together as a story.
He heard those stories as a boy in a refugee camp in Thailand. Like most of the Hmong who've settled in the U.S., he was born in Laos. During the Vietnam War, Hmong soldiers fought as allies of the U.S. After the Americans withdrew, the communist Laotian government targeted the Hmong for destruction and drove them from their mountain homes. Chublong Vang escaped to Thailand when he was 12. There, he wrote for magazines and newspapers, but not in Hmong. He wrote in Thai and Lao. Hmong writing wasn't even taught in the schools. He picked it up from friends and family. When he arrived in St. Paul, he finally discovered a place to write in his native language, the literary journal Pan Dao Voice.
Before I haven't seen the Pan Dao Voice, I feel like I lost something, that I need something because I like to writing. So I'm very great that I have the right group to support my strength.
What I've been trying to do is to move my community from an oral tradition to one that is also written.
My name Mua, founder and editor of Pan Dao Voice.
You know, at the same time, I also don't want to forget about the oral traditions. I want to acknowledge, I want to pay tribute to, I want to study and remember and know what the oral traditions are as well. But in the society, it's still based on text and written text. And so when there aren't Hmong stories, when Hmong writers are not writing stories themselves, then we don't exist, at least on paper.
For a long time, those stories weren't written down. Dr. Yang Dao is a Hmong scholar, and he currently teaches in the Department of Asian Languages and Literature at the University of Minnesota.
We don't have a written traditions. We have a long oral traditions because the Hmong memorize everything.
Everything. Funeral rites, family trees, and history. Like this.
According to the Hmong legend, a long time ago when the Hmong lived in the central part of China, the Hmong people had a writing system, but during a fighting with the Chinese, Han Chinese, about 2,000 years ago, the Hmong troops were defeated by the Chinese, and the Chinese authorities prohibited the Hmong people from learning their own writing system.
For generations, this is how information was passed on. Then in 1952, a group of Catholic missionaries developed a Hmong writing system to translate the Bible. They used the letters A through Z to create the Hmong Romanized popular alphabet.
And so it's usually the last letter of a word that tells you what tone it is.
Again, Mining Mua.
So the K makes the K sound, you know, and then the J tells me that it's go. You know, so this is go. This is you.
She says reading Hmong is pretty easy to learn if you already speak the language. Of course, in the U.S., the younger generation is speaking more English and less Hmong all the time. Many of the elders never learn the writing system. They'll record a cassette and send that to a relative in Laos, who listens to it, then records over it and sends it back. The written language is used in email, in churches, in newspapers. It just takes a while to create a literature, as it would with any new tradition. There are still very few people writing short stories or novels in Hmong. For Mining Mua, it's also important to preserve the old traditions. For example, the name of her journal refers to traditional intricate needlework, Pad Dao. She also wants to record and transcribe Hmong stories and songs. This is a cassette her mother recorded.
This is a traditional Hmong folk song. It's called Gutia. There are people, Hmong people my age or younger, that don't understand these forms. You know, that think that Hmong people don't have poetry, and we don't have writing, and we don't have, you know, our own Cinderella story. And so I think my concern is how to tape and transcribe these things and then make them accessible to the community, you know, and so that we have our own appreciation for Hmong arts.
Dr. Yang Dao teaches Hmong language and traditions at the University of Minnesota. The summer 2003 issue of Pad Dao Voice is out now. These are places where the Hmong language is evolving on the page. And some of the people leading that evolution are Mai Neng Mua and the writer Chu Blong Vang.
It's not a good idea to just forget what you came from and then just adopt to other culture. Actually, you should know both is the best, that where you came from and what culture you're from. And the latter is the only way to keep this culture, this history.
We're lucky if it gets passed, you know, from one generation to the other. But what happens when it doesn't get passed? You know, and even in that passage, things are changed. And there's nothing wrong with that change. But when you don't have the original to compare it to, then all you know is what exists now, you know. And so there's nothing to compare anything to. You know, it's as if we didn't have a past.
For Studio 360, I'm Steve Nelson.
I'm Kurt Anderson with the writer Sarah Nelson, no relation, and we are talking today about reading and about writing things down so that they can be read. It must be, I mean, it's almost unimaginable to me to not have a written language. I mean, and you think back to the European tradition, obviously there was a written language in the 14th century, but I guess printing, when printing came about in 14-whatever, that would have been the comparable moment in the culture, the Western culture at large, when suddenly everything changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what I thought was so interesting in that piece where they said, well, there is a written language and it's used in churches and in email. Did you notice that? I mean, it was so, there is no written language, but now that we have email, there can be a written language. I mean, it just seemed it's hard to imagine.
Well, and especially to be such a anomaly in this modern world, and as you heard, I think we heard the kind of ambivalence and being of two minds about that among the people that Steve talked to in that piece. It must be very difficult because on a you know, that sense of there is no written history or written no literature, therefore you kind of didn't exist mm-hmm. until 1952.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, interesting. The Hmong, there's a wonderful book about the Hmong. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's called The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down.
I know the title.
It's Ann Fadiman. Ann Fadiman's the author, and it's a book about a Hmong child who had, I think it's epilepsy, had seizures. And in the Hmong culture, that is, that means the spirit catches you when you fall down. It's a spiritual seizure. And of course, in Southern California, where this girl lived at the time, I can't remember, she was a pretty little girl, you know, they wanted to investigate it medically. And the culture just did not see it as the Hmong, her family, and did not see it as a medical issue. They saw it as a spiritual issue. And it's an amazing book about how these cultures sort of collided and the doctors that had some ambivalence about making the Hmong parents see it as a medical issue, and they started to see it more as a spiritual issue. It's a great book about that conflict in the culture.
As we were preparing the show, I realized what a brief moment book reading had in our culture, in the Western culture, as the dominant mode of kind of entertainment. I mean, you know, books were too expensive for almost anyone to buy until 1840 or 1850. And then radio and television came in 1930, 40, 50. There was really only a century where books ruled. And do we think that when we look back 100 years from now, it'll be a downhill slope? Will people read books less and less, even as they use the written language and email?
Well, certainly people in the publishing business are afraid of exactly that. But, I mean, it's all storytelling. I mean, if it's storytelling in an email, it's storytelling on television. I mean, those, believe it or not, most television shows are actually written by somebody. There was a few years ago, before the crash, there was a lot of talk about electronic reading and electronic reading devices. And were those things books? And could you call it a book if it was on a screen? It kind of doesn't matter, though. I mean, I love books as they say in the technology industry, books as furniture, books as things to touch and have and
fetishize.
Right, exactly.
But it does require, and I think this is the difference. I guess is, I mean, the difference in why, you know, the book reading world and business always feels a sense of crisis is it's harder. You can't just pay your money, go into the theater, and be immersed in this world. You actually have to work at it, which, of course, for those of us who like reading, is the joy, is that interactive joy of really getting your nerve endings in the book.
Right. And you usually can't do much else while you're doing it. I mean, you can listen to music and be, you know, cleaning the house. You can be, you know, cooking, whatever. Yeah, I mean, it requires a commitment. And I talk in my book about short stories, which I love to read. And a lot of people who love fiction say that short stories are their favorite form of fiction. I have a lot of trouble reading a book of short stories from start to finish. And I really thought this said something terrible about me. And a well-meaning friend said, well, it's because you have to get yourself into every story. So if you have a novel, once you get 20 pages in, or 50 pages, or, you know, or less or more, you're in. With a story, just as you sort of get into it, it's over and you've got to turn around and get into it again. And it requires, you know, that same effort 5 or 6 or 8 times in one book. And I think a lot of people don't want to do that.
But aren't there things that books at their best can do that films and television, even at their best, can't?
Well, I think so. I mean, because basically most movies that we see are based on some written form, often based on a book before that. And I mean, I'd always rather read almost always rather read the book than see the movie, because to me, seeing a movie of a book is like seeing a Xerox of, you know, reading a Xerox of a Xerox. I mean, I'm reading somebody else's interpretation of the book. And when you read the book, you're closer to the author. I mean, of course, you know, it's better if you don't look at the covers of the books and, you know, all kinds of – there are all sorts of interventions. But it seems to me to be a pure and more direct experience to read what somebody wrote. It really almost doesn't matter what the book is. I mean, if you're – you know, that feeling of falling in love with a book, I mean, just not being able to be separated from this thing that you love – I mean, it really is. I talk about this in my book. It really is like falling in love. I mean, it really is like you're just consumed by this thing, and you know, it's crazy, and you just have to, you just have to stay up all night and read the book.
Well, it's funny staying up all night, because that is part of this. I mean, in the well structured bourgeois life that I lead, when I'm up at like 2 a.m. reading a book, I do feel like that's as transgressive as I tend to get in my regular life. You know, I feel like I'm doing something naughty.
Well. Well, we'll just skip over that. But no, but I think the highest compliment that one can pay to a writer is, you know, I stayed up all night reading your book. I mean, because I think all of us who love to read know what that feeling is. I mean, and it's really you're exhausted and you need to go to sleep and you got to get up in the morning and the kids got to go to school or whatever it is. And you just don't care. You just don't care because you cannot, you know, separate from this being, you know, from this creature. And once you have had that feeling, I mean, we'll not make the obvious comparison, you know, to human interaction. But once you have had that feeling, you can't live without it. I mean, you know what it is to feel that way. And, you know, your whole life is, your whole reading life is a quest to feel that way again.
Sarah Nelson, thank you for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thank you.
Sarah Nelson's book, which is called So Many Books, So Little Time, will be in bookstores within minutes or days. You can find out more about her and about any of the stories you heard today at studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Ave Carrillo,
Michelle Siegel,
Andy Lancet,
Trent Wolbe,
John H. Stanek III.
Special thanks to Sarah Nobles for her work on the Person on the Street interviews. Our theme music was composed by David Van Tiegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by donors to PRI's Producers Forum, who include Dr. Claire Gaudiani and Christopher and Elizabeth Sullivan. Additional support is provided by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, accelerating entrepreneurship across America, on the web at kauffman.org, and by audible.com, where you can download audio of this show and other public radio programs, as well as best-selling books and the New York Times, all at audible.com/studio360.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
I have a very mixed picture of America.
We talked to the film director Lars von Trier about how he sees the USA.
America belongs to me. I don't have to go there. I can, it belongs to my dreams.
Us and Them, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.